How efficiently do people live the religious life? We know that where the masses today are concerned, in a great many parts of the world, they have turned away from religion as understood through the centuries. Technology, the control over matter, the ease with which one can indulge one's desires and senses, fulfill one's, or shall I say, gratify one's own wishes, has made people feel that they are masters of the situation, can do, and they can do what they like. So they live a life which is powerfully self-oriented, self-concerned, which is considerate of others only in so far as it is comfortable to do so. Otherwise, they act in a way which is harmful, provided they can get away with it. That is the attitude of too many people today. On the other hand, there are also those who stick to the old conceptions of the religious life. A routine procedure, the observance of ritual. The fulfillment of certain precepts, mostly moral precepts, regarding living the good life. And having done that, they feel themselves in right relationship with the source of things, with the Creator, or whatever they like to call the ultimate real, and are more or less satisfied with that. There are still others, and they are fewer in number, who are profoundly concerned with the religious life, in the old sense of the word, preserving the old religions, the doctrines, the teachings, appreciating the inner significance of the ceremonial, the ritual, and so forth, the act of worship, the act of worship in human fellowship, and all the rest of it. And these people do feel concerned that somehow this is not quite the answer to the modern world and modern conditions. They are disturbed. And they find that the living of the religious life, as they live it and as others live it around them, is somewhat inefficient. Sometimes they get very violent reactions. So they throw overboard everything to do with religion as such. Then there are others still who turn away from the religion in which they were born. They are dissatisfied with it for some reason or other. And they seek the deeps in other religions, other faiths, and often find satisfaction in them. They find themselves temperamentally suited to these forms which are other than the form practiced by their own race and culture. But if we look at this phenomenon carefully, we will find that quite often, not in every case, but quite often, they are only substituting another method for satisfaction, for the old method, which was their birthright from childhood onwards, and which they have rejected because they were unsatisfied with it. But if one goes deeply into it, one sees that it is a form of self-seeking still. One seeks answers for oneself in order to solve one's own problems, whatever they may be. The problem at root is likely to be the satisfaction of a spiritual hunger, or the answer to a spiritual urge from within towards that which indeed is truth. But yet it is in the form of satisfaction for oneself. There is a very strong self-orientation involved in it. Now, until there is complete freedom from self-orientation, religion, in its profound sense, in its deep sense, is still not in our lives. Religion begins with the unselfed state. It begins with the truly saintly state, the truly virtuous state. This is something which very, very few people throughout history ever wake up to and see and understand. For us today, and for the world as it is today, and on account of the direction in which it is moving, evolutionarily, it is essential that we understand this. Some of us at least must understand it. Put it into practice. And let it be an influence for the good of mankind in the decades and centuries to come. Because the world as a whole is definitely entering a new phase. It has entered a new phase. And it's a phase which will be a tremendous arc in history, lasting maybe a millennium or two. Now, how do we see this? How do we enter into it? It is easy enough to say the deeps of religion begin with the unselfed state. And immediately the person who is sincere, earnest, will naturally say, well, how do I become unselfed? But you see the form in which the question is couched. How do I become unselfed? I can never become unselfed. The unself state can become manifest through me, the living existent being, and others are more likely to be aware of it than this living existent being. we have to have self-consciousness. Otherwise, it would be impossible to be in charge of the organism which is here, which is commonly called oneself, the body-mind organism. This body-mind organism has to be self-conscious, aware of itself as a distinct entity in relationship with the outside world. Otherwise it would perish if it hadn't that much wide awakeness. Very good. So that much self-consciousness there must be. Also there must be sufficient self-consciousness in order to look after this organism properly and not become a liability upon society. And we know that society always has had, and perhaps in modern times in certain respects, has an even larger number of organisms which are liabilities upon the state. So one must have that much self-consciousness. And then also one must have sufficient self-consciousness to know how this organism should be treated, educated, expressed in life in order that it may be an asset to the environment and the society in which it lives. But having said those things, we have understood the lesser part of the significance of our whole existence and of the way we should live in the world. Because we human beings have to do something which the other kingdoms of nature on the planet do not do. The other kingdoms of nature have developed in such a way as to come to the climax, which we commonly call egohood, self-consciousness, egohood, proper self-consciousness. Having come thus far, the animal has come to perfection, the animal in us. But there is that in us which the animal and the plant and the mineral kingdoms of the planet do not have. And that is the capacity to go beyond all separative, isolative self-consciousness. And thereby enable the particular organism, which is oneself, to be in harmonious relationship with the total environment. And even beyond, not only to be in harmonious relationship with the total environment, but to be completely free of the separation between self and not self. When this emerges in the individual, then transcendence is being realized through the individual. And that is what the human can do. And when transcendence is being realized through the individual, man has come to his supreme fulfillment as a human creature. But that is something which is absolutely tremendous. It is difficult enough to see the vision and appreciate its immensity, its profound significance for the life of the whole planet. It's difficult enough to do that. how much more difficult is the task of living like that naturally, with that vision and the capacity for the expression of that vision to be second nature with us. But such were the first fruits of our humanity, the great spiritual teachers. Now let's come back to the way in which this question is asked. How do I become unself? The question is a wrong question. The question is one which postulates the individual achieving a goal, a preconceived goal. This is where the mistake comes. Consider, for instance, how we take to all kinds of techniques, meditation, or yoga, or going through anyone's particular system, and so forth. What is it all direct? What is all that effort directed towards? That I may become thus, or attain this, that, or the other. We may deliberately shut that out of our consciousness. But that doesn't in the least mean that we have outgrown that. We have only repressed it deep down into the subconscious. You see? And it works in the inner depths of the mind and continually defeats any practice one may go through, which, if rightly understood and rightly practiced, would flower out naturally in the realization of transcendence through that person. You see, it's very, very important to really to get hold of this. You know how it is. If you want to deal with a snake, you must know where and how to catch him so that he is harmless. There is a special skill which one develops for this purpose. Then that poisonous snake cannot harm the person who knows how to get hold of him. We have to do something like that. This poisonous snake of selfness, isolative selfness, lies at the root of sin, suffering, misery, trouble, frustration, failure, evil. Lies at the root of it. How to get hold of this snake, which, remember, is myself. This is the important point. We haven't got to kill him. We haven't got to throw him away, get rid of him. We've got to catch hold of him in the right way. And no more does that snake poison one's life. That snake is transformed then into the serpent of wisdom. See, we really must appreciate this. Now one might say, oh well, right, let's search out the depths. I'll spend my time 24 hours of the day in concentrated meditation, search the depths, dig out this serpent. But the whole of me is that serpent. That's that poisonous snake, I mean. You see? The whole of me is that poisonous snake. Now, if we observe the process of life in stillness and quietness, everything that is in the depths tends to come up and display itself. What is kept down by force, what remains down out of fear for what is up, will all come up if oneself is still and quiet. And there are some great significances of this stillness and quietness. It's a state in which one has ceased to be possessive. In ceasing to be possessive, one ceases to seek for self. It's a very strange thing. Where does possessiveness start? Starts right with the body itself, doesn't it? We always say, my body. We talk of another body as his body or her body. I am the proprietor, the owner of my body. Let us just spend a few minutes very intently considering this carefully. See? Just let the body be perfectly at rest, easy. And let the rhythm of the breath get established. Let the body be free of all muscular strains. Only the healthy, elastic tension is what should be present. The lithe muscle has its own tone, its tension. It's elastic, it's healthy. But all strains, let them ease off. Just be quietly aware of the breath as it enters the nostrils and of the rhythmic movement of the diaphragm. Good. This breath rhythm is actually the life rhythm. Let the mind become aware of that intensely. It's a life rhythm of which breath is just one fragment. And let it permeate the whole being, the whole psychophysical being. And let the peace and perfection of rhythm ease away everything that is unhappy, painful. Ease away the excitement and strain of pleasure, as well as of pain. Now let the mind quietly consider, quietly but intensely and see the fact about the body. It's made up of elements, fundamental elements, which come out of the world stock of these very elements. Today we use scientific terms. In the old days they simply said, and that is as much as they knew, earth, water, air, fire, and they added what we today call ether, or rather we used to use that word ether up till the end of the last century. The body is made up of these elements. And whether we think of it in terms of the chemical elements of today, or the five elements of past centuries, these elements, whilst atomistically changeless, indestructible, and so forth, in their combinations and in their making up of the body, are impermanent. That is to say, the pattern which is formed and which is what we experience through our senses and the brain and the mind, this pattern is impermanent. It appears in space and time, lives its little span, and then dies. And this is what we commonly call my body. But to grasp at the impermanent, or to regard it as one's property, is hardly wisdom. In fact, it is powerful and positive unwisdom, because it feeds that illusion of a postulated entity called I, which is only an abstraction by our own minds of what our senses convey to us about ourselves. That is why the proprietary feeling over one's own body is a mistake. It feeds, it enhances isolative self-consciousness. And it feeds and enhances all the mistaken procedures associated with the body. Pampering the body, indulging it instead of utilizing it. Utilizing it rightly. It feeds vanity. It feeds egoism. Egoism is very strongly linked up, tied up with the sense of ownership. Selfness is rooted, strongly rooted in the sense of ownership. But see it as a phenomenon, a continual becoming process, which has purpose whilst it is taking place, but which has no permanence. No separate identity which is changeless through time and space. These are some of the illusions from which we suffer. So let them go. This living body is here, a changing, continuously changing phenomenon through time and space, sufficiently coherent, sufficiently cohesive to be recognized as this particular person who is living through the years. And when that span is over, there is complete disintegration and no identifiability is possible. Just be quietly aware. Quietly but intensely. Practice this type of meditation at home, by yourself. And if it is sufficiently intense, you will see vanity, egoism, fear, anxiety for self-continuance and so forth. All those will diminish tremendously, perhaps vanish away altogether. Now, if you can be really aware of it, not merely look at it at a distance, not see it purely intellectually as a set of words, but really be aware, awake to the living fact of it, then this which is commonly called one's self is a passing manifestation of the unselfed state which is actually present here and now. So we can see what happens in actual fact where there is real growth, fruition, realization. It is not a case of I becoming unselfed, but the unselfed state emerges because one sees the meaning, the root of selfness. In in becoming intensely aware of the fact of selfness, then that selfness dissolves away. Its dissolution means that the unselfed state is present. So, property, any property of which one's own body, as we commonly say, describe it, is the property which is very strong in our consciousness. My body. And if the proprietary sense dissolves, then there comes in a true sense of trusteeship, instead of owning this body. One is the trustee for it. And good trusteeship is there in the absence of vanity, egoism, indulgence, pampering, misuse, and all the rest of it. That is surely quite obvious, isn't it? Good trusteeship. So that in seeing this, it becomes easy, becomes natural to live the simple life, the good life. There is no question then of giving up this, of forcing oneself to do that, and so on and so on. All those, the ways of conflict, are the ways of misery and of the miserable minded. Let life live. Life is a mystery. But oneself can awaken to the truth. So, freedom from all sense of ownership, and therefore from all grasping, then one is a good trustee. Self. Gives place to the unselfed reality. When one really sees it, there are no arguments about it. It just is so. And then the body is happy. Its natural healthiness is also its happiness, its well-being. All right, stop for a moment. Now, just remaining quite still and quiet. Let us consider another point which touches strongly upon this question with which we started: how efficiently does one live the religious life? Even very sincere and perceptive people often approach religion with the desire that it will solve their personal problems for them. Religion will not do anything of the sort. That is to say, I'm not talking of superficial religion. I'm talking of religion in its depth, in its innermost reality. For religion in its innermost reality is the context of transcendence itself. And in transcendence there is no such thing as personal or its opposite, which we intellectually postulate, impersonal. It is transpersonal. It is whole. There is no isolation of one part in relation to all the other parts which make up the unity of the whole. And since religion is concerned with transcendence, with that transcendent awareness wherein there is no isolative self-consciousness, there is no such thing as a personal problem which lies in the context, in the sphere of religion. Now let us not misunderstand this. Life, the environment, the becoming process, as we call it, through time and space, will everlastingly throw up challenges to us. Every situation will hold a challenge to any individual in the situation. As long as I approach the situation, regard the situation with a self-consciousness which is isolative, and therefore a consciousness which is self-concerned, has particular interests of its own as different from the universal interest, which is the coming to fruition and fulfillment of the entire becoming process. As long as I do that, the challenge which I am looking at, which I am facing, will become a personal problem. Every challenge that life presents us through every day of our existence becomes personalized, because I am the personalizer. I am the personalizer because I am not awake to the whole. I cling to self possessively, like the owner of the self, against the environment, insofar as the environment tends to or actually hurts me. This is how I make my mistake. But if I attend totally to the environment, to the challenge which is presented to me as such, I, the living existent here, with the necessary degree of self-consciousness, which will make the organism act rightly, and so forth, but free of that self-consciousness, or that isolative self-consciousness, which puts me in enmity, in conflict, or separate from the totality, then I personalize the challenge and enter the conflict. I take sides for myself as against so and so. Therefore, the problems become personal problems in that way. Transcendence does not deal with isolated particulars. In the context of transcendence, there is only the totality. And that totality includes everything which, as perceived by us as we are at present constituted, is seen as pain, pleasure, joy, sorrow, gratification, frustration, and so on. The whole sphere of duality. So, to approach religion, or to hope, or to wish that religious living will solve my problems is quite an irreligious thing. Consider how mankind, through the hundreds of thousands of years, literally, has offered petitionary prayer. What for? Has performed placatory rites, and some of them so cruel, so bestial, so utterly ungodly, in order that his particular desires may be satisfied, his personal problems may be solved. We who are here, at least intellectually, can perceive this. But all intellectual perception is relatively shallow. It is a beginning. It is an indispensable beginning. But it remains shallow. When we see wonderful things and we get insights through intellectual perception, they are good, they are useful, but it is like the state when one was a little child and rather daringly and somewhat fearfully, paddled in the shallows and went a little bit deeper. And as soon as suddenly it went out of its depth, it struggled hard and rose to the surface and ran back to the shore for safety. And that's about as much as intellectual perception will do. There is fear, and there is, number one, to be safeguarded. But do see this, and it will be the test of your real insight and your faith. Do see this, that where transcendence is concerned, freely give, totally, fearlessly. There is nowhere where you will drown in transcendence. Transcendence is eternal life, absolute power, in which there is no destruction in the sense of annihilation. No death which is absolute death, annihilation. Nothing at all like that. It is as if you could go out in your spaceship into real outer space and then jump out of it. There is no such thing as falling and bumping and getting hurt. You'll just move through the infinitudes, alive, free. How do the stars move but that way? It's true that we know scientifically, occasionally they bump into each other. But perhaps 2 out of 100,000 million may bump like that. What are the chances? And that is physical. Where transcendence is concerned, there is no such thing as explosion. There is no such thing as implosion either. So, be fearless. We are trusting the transcendence is concerned. You will know its deathlessness. What were the first words of the Buddha after the enlightenment to the 5 disciples? Hearken, because the deathless has been found. How extraordinarily meaningful, but who appreciates the meaning of it? The little brains of mighty scholars twiddle words and phrases around, but the eyes of the spirit are shut. You see, when the eyes of the spirit open and it fills your consciousness, your awareness, this whole becoming process, pleasure, pain, joy, sorrow, achievement, frustration, the whole thing, all these petty little things which become and are called my personal problems, the whole lot of it vanishes before it. You absorb it all into your own being and spirit, unself-consciously, but wide awake. And in that unself-conscious, wide awakeness, you deal with it rightly. You cannot help but deal with it rightly. Now you see, this state of integration into transcendence, which emerges, is one in which pure mind in itself is functioning through you. Mind is a mystery. Everyone in the world says, I thought, I felt, in my mind's eye. They've used the word mind. Ask a person, what do you mean by mind? Do you know what mind is? He doesn't. Even in the lesser sense of the particular psychophysical organism, he doesn't know what mind in itself is. He can observe certain mental phenomena, certain emotional states, be aware of them. We do call them, and rightly call them, mental states and so on. But mind, what is this thing, mind? It is easy enough to get the illusion of my body. But it is also easy to see, to get beyond this illusion of, in this proprietary sense, my body. But the illusion of my mind is a very much subtler illusion altogether. Just as the elements composing this come out of the universal store of matter, as we call it, and makes this temporary pattern, so out of the universal whatever it is to which we apply the word mind, something happens within the living organism which produces phenomena which we call mental processes. Now you may remember I have suggested time and again in the last 3 years or so, 4 years now, practically, that it could be helpful to approach the understanding of mind as the receptive, responsive sensitivity which characterizes the living organism. Now that is one aspect of the story. It is the aspect that touches each living organism. This living organism, that living organism, that living organism has this sensitivity, or manifests this sensitivity, receptive responsive sensitivity, which we call mind. And human beings call it mind especially because they have the faculty of speech. Don't forget that. This faculty of speech plays a tremendous part in our whole existence. All right. That is one approach to mind. There is another, the other side of the coin, so to say, which complements this. This is insofar as it touches the individual self. But this other is that which is universal, and this is mind as power, as transcendent energy, the energy which we cannot measure and control and deal with, as we can measure, control, deal with electricity or electromagnetism or whatever the forces are, physical forces, physical energies of the world. This is transcendent energy, power. Yoga deals with it. Any truly religious way, method, deals with it. But remember, it's an overwhelming power. It is amoral. It has nothing to do with our human moralities. It is energy. Power. You see? Now, that transcendent universal power utilizes the living organism as an apparatus through which it can work. We human beings on this planet are the most developed organisms for such utilization. So it behoves us so to prepare ourselves to be fit apparatus, pure, strong, resilient, unresisting, capable of taking the charge, so to say, and letting it work through us rightly. Now, this power is the meaning of the word virtue. So that a living being, a living human being, the psychophysical organism, if the physical body is healthy and so on, it is a happy body. If the psychical part is healthy, harmonious, balanced, functioning perfectly, and all the rest of it, there is the virtuous mind there. Now note one very important point. This virtuous mind is right out of the sphere of ambivalence. It has transcended it. We are caught up in this ambivalent condition of the conflict which we call fighting the good fight against evil and striving to develop virtue. Just as the power of life is beyond any ambivalence and functions freely through the healthy organism, the healthy body, the person who lives a decent life in the real sense, food, drink, and the whole lot of it, you see. And just as that power of life is transcendent and beyond all ambivalence, and therefore outside the realm of conflict, so too this virtue, this transcendent mind, is outside the sphere of conflict. You can't therefore seek or develop virtue. You see how easily the verbal formulations in religious teaching have gone astray. Too many of them, in certain senses, are misleading. You see, try and just feel it out. How utterly blissful, happy, how peaceful, how natural, how right it is just to let the reality of transcendence work unhindered by us, through us. One has to see this, to be wide awake, not to take sides, to be free of, and to be free of the burden of doctrines and dogmas and teachings and all the rest of it, which are verbal formulations which the person grabs hold of possessively as a proprietor. These are my beliefs, my convictions and all the rest of it. A belief is there. A conviction is there. Be open. Watch it. It will dissolve away. There is no assumption, no conception, no teaching formulated verbally, etc., which has any warrant in terms of ultimate reality or the supreme truth. And you see, if you see this, then the whole situation in life, day-to-day life, is completely changed. There are problems. Of course there are problems, because life is constantly throwing up challenges. But they never are personal problems for me. Although I'm right in the midst of them. I go through the fire unscorched. See, loneliness, fear, depression, wistfulness, sadness. Life hurts us, as we say. And doesn't it hurt us dreadfully all along the line? All this happens as long as one hasn't sort of opened one's eyes. So this possessiveness, proprietariness, which starts with the body, which extends to the mind, let that all go. Just let it go. And see. How the flower of pure being blossoms through you yourself. The Buddha said, Ananda, the freedom of mind from all grasping is nirvana.